From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. D-Day commemorations were held today in Portsmouth, England, ahead of tomorrow's memorial just across the channel on the beaches of Normandy. President Trump was there today with other world leaders to honor this, the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings. During a ceremony, the president read a prayer that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivered on the radio before that massive invasion took place.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
NPR's Frank Langfitt is in London. Frank, an incredibly somber day before the day in which so many Allied troops were killed on the beaches of Normandy. And in that landing, they helped liberate Europe from the Nazis. Tell us more about what happened in Portsmouth.
Well, it was interesting, I think, to watch, to see the Queen, Prince Charles, and Donald Trump sitting together in a sort of, at least it's an apolitical context. Obviously, there's been ups and downs between the United Kingdom and the United States, but to see them coming together, you had 300 veterans from the D-Day landings were on hand. Some of them marched out across the stage in their 90s on canes. Many as they were watching this, they were weeping, and people got up and spoke. Veterans saying we should never forget. And then later, a parachutist actually recreated the airdrop into France, flew across the channel. And that was just – that was quite something to see. Remember, this was 75 years ago, but an extraordinary battle and a big turning point in the war.
As we've mentioned elsewhere, you know, the 82nd Airborne was dreamt up, this idea of maybe if we put our troops in parachutes, in airplanes, we can drop them behind enemy lines, and there they were. But some of the tone of these remembrances today seemed a little off to you, we're hearing?
Well, it was actually sort of interesting. It was really drenched in nostalgia, which I guess to some degree we can understand. But at one point there was people came on in period costume dancing. It seemed like a USO review from the 40s, almost like a Broadway review. And I think it almost felt like it might be a little more appropriate for a Victory in Europe commemoration. Let's give a listen.
Yeah.
He was famous jumping man from Chicago way. He had a new sound that no one else could play.
Okay. Oh, dear. You know, I mean, but for those veterans standing there, this was the music of their day, so maybe
it was, and I'm sure that for them it was very nostalgic. And of course, people did not know exactly the way the war would go, and it was an extraordinary victory against what was clearly an evil force at work there in Nazi Germany.
This is not supposed to be a political day. It hasn't been in many years, but it can't help but have the whiff of it, I would imagine, this week. There you had President Trump standing in front of a giant image of FDR, who formed this alliance with Canada and Britain to save the continent. Here you have Trump in Britain pushing for Brexit, for leaving an alliance.
Yeah, it's poignant, Robin, in the sense that what they were commemorating is particularly these countries and other allies coming together to invade and free the continent 75 years ago, an extraordinary moment. And yet today we find the West divided. Certainly, I mean, the nations themselves are divided. The United Kingdom and the United States are split. There's populist movements on the continent. And particularly if you look at Brexiteers, if you look at Mr. Trump, they're not they don't like some of these multilateral alliances, the idea of these countries coming together. They want their own countries to be America first, Britain first, that sort of thing. And so there is this sense of fragmentation. So it's a very interesting moment to be watching these images of unity at a time of a lot of division.
Well, and some are seeing in some of these populist movements across the continent, some of the more far-right populist movements, a whiff of Nazism.
There is. The word fascism gets thrown around a lot. In fact, just – gosh, was it yesterday? I was interviewing the mayor of London who was complaining that he felt President Trump in some of his electoral tactics in the United States was echoing fascist rhetoric from Europe in the 30s and the 40s, which is an extraordinarily strong thing to say, especially coming from the mayor of London. But there is talk of that, and certainly on the continent you do see things along those lines. So It's not an easy time in the West, and I think also there are challenges to the West from authoritarian nations, at least to the values of the West in terms of free speech, democracy, things of those sorts that we see in the East from authoritarian nations like China and Russia. So it feels like a very unsettled time as we commemorate the D-Day invasion.
And President Trump will be staying the night in Ireland and then off to France for tomorrow's commemorations. NPR's Frank Langfitt in London across the channel. Frank, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Well, now to the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez, which is facing a dual crisis, an overflow of people trying to get into the U.S. or have been deported from the U.S., and an upsurge in violence due to a resumption of gang wars. Emily Green reports that combination threatens a decade of economic and social rebirth.
These days, musicians line the streets of Juarez playing for large crowds. But there are signs of trouble. Last year, the murder rate rose to a level not seen in nearly a decade. Rival criminal groups are vying for control of the lucrative drug trade and also smuggling routes into the U.S., and they're targeting migrants, people like Jose. He fled Honduras last year.
Yo buscaba un coyote que me pasara para allá.
He says when he got to Juarez, he asked for a coyote who could smuggle him into the U.S. They told him the price was $3,500. When Jose walked away, the coyotes kidnapped him. Jose and the other migrants interviewed for this story asked not to use their last name for fear of retribution. He says they took him to an abandoned house. There was a single blanket thrown on the ground. He says they kept asking if he had family in the U.S., who they were, where they lived, their phone number. The kidnappers wanted to extort them in exchange for Jose's life. They also gave Jose another option. They told him they would cross him into the U.S. for free if he brought something with him. Jose thinks they were referring to drugs. He wasn't interested. After nearly a week, he escaped through a window. The clash of ruthless cartels and vulnerable migrants is a dangerous combination, says David Shirk, a professor at the University of San Diego who studies crime in Mexico.
If you've got a large number of people who are really desperate to survive, number one, but they're also desperate to get into the United States, that's a really good potential situation for a criminal organization. You want to get into the United States? We can help you get into the United States, but you're going to have to carry these things with you.
And the more migrants and deportees there are in one place, the more at risk they become, says Stephanie Leuter, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin who studies Central American migration.
If there's 5 deportees in your big criminal organization, it might not be that interesting because that's really not that much money for you. It's 5 people. If it's 500, a little more interesting. If it's 5,000, that's a lot of money all of a sudden. You might want to get into that business, whether it's kidnapping, whether it's recruiting.
While Juarez has always been a city migrants and deportees pass through, it's never seen this many. There are around 3,000 migrants waiting to cross at the port of entry and claim asylum in the U.S. Add to that the more than 3,100 migrants who reached the U.S. already but have been sent back to Juarez to wait while their asylum cases are decided. Finally, the number of Mexicans deported to Juarez has nearly doubled over the last year because the U.S. stopped flying them to Mexico City.
Son personas que pueden caer muy fácilmente en manos de la delincuencia.
Rogelio Loya oversees social programs in Juarez. He says it would be easy for these migrants and deportees to fall into criminal activity, not because they're bad people, but because they're vulnerable. Many don't have money to eat or places to sleep. At one shelter in Juarez, mattresses line a large gymnasium-like room to accommodate the overflowing number of people. City officials here estimate there could be at least 10,000 migrants and deported Mexicans in Juarez by summer's end, a big problem because the city only has 1,300 shelter beds. One man, Javier, is scared the shelter will tell him he has to leave to make space for others. So he guards the front door for hours on end to make himself useful.
El temor es que cuando yo vine como a los 15 o 20 días mataron una persona
He lists off the murders that have happened since he arrived. Most recently, 300 men were murdered in a house close to the shelter. The fear of something bad happening, he says, is always there. For NPR News, I'm Emily Green.
Well, yet again this week, we saw President Trump complain on Twitter about media coverage. Not the first president to say that he is not feeling that he's being treated fairly by the press, of course. But the Chicago Tribune, Robin, has just published some letters Abraham Lincoln wrote to the editor-in-chief of what was then the Chicago Press and Tribune, including one from June 27, 1858, that said, "How in God's name do you let such paragraphs into the Tribune? Does Sheehan write them?" He was talking about James Sheehan, editor of the Chicago Times. "I confess," says Lincoln, "it astonishes me." And a few weeks earlier, he wrote, "I wrote this chiefly to express my regret that articles like the enclosed should appear in our own Republican papers, planting poisonous thorns to rankle in the bosoms of our own best men." Ouch. Abraham Lincoln.
Well, he was honest.
Honest Abe. You can find the article about Lincoln's angry letters on our Twitter feed at Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
President Trump is in Ireland after wrapping his state visit to Britain. But before he left, ears perked up when he told Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain, there's always a chance of military action against Iran. And after a long talk with Prince Charles about climate change, Trump said, despite the almost complete scientific agreement, he still isn't convinced it's human caused.
"I believe that there's a change in weather, and I think it changes both ways. Don't forget, it used to be called global warming. That wasn't working. Then it was called climate change. Now it's actually called extreme weather."
Here at home, President Trump is facing Republican opposition to his threat to impose tariffs on Mexico starting next week. So let's bring in our political strategist, Bill Press, former head of the California Democratic Party and host now of the Bill Press podcast. Hi, Bill. Congratulations on
the new iteration.
And Alice Stewart.
Hello.
Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so even before landing in the UK, President Trump criticized London's mayor and Meghan Markle. We've heard all about that. He was denying, though, that protests were taking place because he says he didn't see them. Here he is yesterday in a news conference with Prime Minister May.
"And then I heard that there were protests. I said, where are the protests? I don't see any protests. I did see a small protest today when I came, very small. So a lot of it is fake news, I hate to say."
Alice, it's not fake news, as you know. You've seen the pictures of the protesters who were there. Maybe the protests weren't as big as some people thought that they would be, but there were protesters. Does truth matter here? I mean, he's saying something that's just not true.
It does matter, and it should matter, and it should be standard protocol for administration officials to acknowledge if there are protesters, there are protesters. And the reality is that, unfortunately, some people tend to focus more on the protesters than the progress made during the trip. Look, we might not like the protesters. We may not like the message they gave, but the fact remains they were there. We'll point out, as you did, the numbers were much smaller than in years past, and the message was basically on their support for global warming policies and the president's opposition to such. And they obviously also disagreed with the president's tone and tenor, and they made that quite clear. Mm-hmm. But in the grand scheme of things, as he has left London, there are far more things that are positive and to tout than are negative, which are a result of these protesters.
Well, and we've done analysis elsewhere, but I guess, Bill, I want to ask you, because there has been, you know, bad news for the president, whether it's protesters or there's another devastating book from Michael Wolff, much of the insight about Trump in that book from former aide Steve Bannon. And on Morning Edition, Wolff called Trump functionally a madman. Jack Holmes wrote that piece last weekend in Esquire, saying it's time to stop pretending Donald Trump is some particularly eccentric character operating in a functioning democratic system. He is unstable. He is a menace. What do Democrats do? You know, given that there are people saying this about, you know, the president of the United States, do Democrats press forward and see what and do what some Americans would see as a coup? You know, start impeachment proceedings. Do they do nothing when someone, you know, many people are saying there's an unstable person in the White House?
Well, let me first of all say that if Donald Trump gets any job after he leaves the White House, it will not be counting crowds. OK, I mean, I think that's one thing, because remember the inauguration, it's a small crowd. He said it was the largest ever in history. And now you had 75,000 in the streets of London.
Matter. It doesn't seem to matter.
Well, only as in it does matter, as Alice said. The truth does matter. And I think everybody just sees this is Trump being Trump. I mean, I think Alice said there were so many things that were good about this visit. I don't see one thing that was accomplished by this visit. Nothing on Brexit, nothing on a trade deal. He dragged his entire family along and sort of embarrassed everybody. He tweeted nonstop, even after went after Bette Midler from England. But to your question, Robin, I think Democrats just, into that side, they let Trump be Trump. They can't make Trump any worse, I believe, than he appears to be. And then they focus on their legislative agenda and show that they were elected to get things done, and they got things done. And at the same time, they hold their investigative hearings, and we'll see where those go. They may go to impeachment. They may not.
Well, and they've got a new line of investigation that they can pick up on, because the New York Times reported this week that Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, who also happens to be the wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, has ties to this big shipping company called Foremost Group. It's her family's shipping business. It's made big donations to her husband, and her efforts to boost it in China were noticed by the Times, where the company has very deep ties, and she didn't disclose it. Alice, these kinds of stories have been problems for Trump cabinet members in the past. A number of them have had to go because of stuff like this. Is this going to be a problem for Elaine Chao?
I don't see it as such. She's done a tremendous job in her role as transportation secretary. But it is a cause for concern with regard to what are the business ties and the business relationships with a lot of people that are serving in our administration at this point. And these are important questions to ask. But this is nothing new. This hasn't happened. This has happened in the past. There were questions about business relationships with Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation and business ties that were in that administration as well. These are nothing new. I would like to think that the questions will be asked and answered, and Secretary Chao can go about her job that she's doing as transportation secretary.
Yeah, can I say, Jeremy,
yeah,
I think this is worth an investigation to see if there's any real conflict there or not. We don't know. What strikes me about this is that for ties to Chinese businesses and Chinese trade, that this is in direct contrast or conflict with Donald Trump's position on throwing all these tariffs on China. And I just wonder why Elaine Chao has not spoken up about that, or maybe even resigned because of it.
Well, so there is that. But I want to ask about this new evidence that surfaced. It was found on a deceased Republican strategist's hard drive. I'm sure strategists everywhere are making a note about that. But Alice, this is documents that pretty clearly show that the administration wanted to add the "Are you a citizen?" question to the census, to frighten away non-citizens and give Republicans and whites an electoral advantage. The documents show that saying, as the administration did before the courts, that they wanted the question to help enforce the Voting Rights Act to help minorities was just a front. Unseemly, unethical, what else?
I see absolutely zero problem with this question being on the census.
Even with the reasoning?
The reasoning behind that, or what they say was the reason behind it, is certainly worth checking into. But why in the world is there a problem with asking, is this person a citizen of the United States? Look, if this was unseemly, or if this is not proper, or in some cases people refer to this as racist, if this is a racist question now, was it racist when it was on President Clinton's extended form, census form? Was it racist and unseemly when it was on President Obama's long-form census form? Those are questions that need to be asked. If it was okay then, there should not be a problem with it now.
Bill?
I believe it is absolutely racist, and I think it's clearly political, and I think the word for this is busted. Wilbur Ross is busted. He lied to Congress when he said this was all about getting an accurate count. And this is in court today. It'll be before the it's already before the Supreme Court. They're supposed to rule on it by the end of the month. I think it's a no-brainer. The Constitution says the census every 10 years is intended to get to determine, quote, the whole number of persons in each state. And because so many federal dollars are allocated depending on the total number of people, not just the total number of citizens, there are going to be states and cities and counties that will be badly served and underfunded, all kinds of programs from transportation to health care, if this stays on the census.
Okay, let's just take a couple minutes for 2020 here. And Joe Biden, again, leading the polls on the Democratic side right now, although we haven't had the debates yet and things could change. But I want to listen to a cut of Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend mayor, who was on an MSNBC forum with Chris Matthews this week. And it just starts to sound like the gloves are coming off. Buttigieg making some comments about what could be Biden. Let's listen.
I guess the point is, if we have a campaign where the theme is, let's go back to normal, then I think it's
going
to... That's
what Biden wants, is it? You're suggesting Biden would do that.
I'm not going to talk to anybody else's campaign
strategy. Oh, yes, you are. This is an indirect shot at Biden. Come on.
Look, and he even polled the audience, and they said, yeah, it's about Biden. But, Bill, are the gloves starting to come off as the other candidates look for a path to the nomination?
I hope they are. I think that's what primary is all about. And the gloves are particularly coming off on the part of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg and others toward Joe Biden, because he's the front runner and they have to knock him down. That's politics. I must say, though, that Buttigieg may not like it. But what I hear from a lot of Democrats is, yeah, you know, we want somebody who's stable, dependable, whatever, can deliver and is a proven record. And that does sort of describe Joe Biden.
Go ahead. If you look at it, it makes no sense in a primary, especially this large, to punch down. So they're all going to punch up. And punching up is Joe Biden. And what we're seeing, many of them share the same policies. They're very similar on the issues. So what they do is they try to find a distinct contrast between themselves and Biden. As we heard, Buttigieg is using the generational argument. Sanders and Warren are saying they're a little further left than Biden is. Kamala Harris is touting the fact she is a female and a minority. And Hickenlooper, I don't really suggest this in a primary. He's saying, I'm going to run to the right of Biden. I don't recommend that in a primary. It might work if he got to the general. But all of them are finding their unique contrast with Biden and using
them. Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist, Bill Press, the host of the Bill Press podcast, a Democratic strategist. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is clamping down on travel to Cuba. This week, the Treasury Department said it's banning cruises and some forms of group travel to Cuba by Americans that had become popular after the Obama administration restored ties with Cuba in 2015. According to the Trump administration, the aim is to deprive Cuba of U.S. dollars that the Trump administration says are being used to prop up the Maduro regime in Venezuela. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan here, now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, what exactly is changing under these new restrictions? Because a lot of Americans have been making trips to Cuba recently.
They sure have. As you mentioned, cruise lines banned from going there. That's a big deal because Havana had become a popular and a very profitable destination for the major cruise lines. People paying more for itineraries that included Havana. No surprise that the three major cruise lines, their shares have been trading lower today on a day when the broader market has been doing rather well. The Trump administration also banning what it calls educational travel to Cuba. Now, that was one of 12 permitted categories of travel to Cuba. So that might not sound like a big deal, one of 12, right? But it matters because that was kind of this catch-all category that anybody who felt like, well, hey, I'm traveling, of course I'm learning something that's educational, could kind of justify it that way. The other categories are much more specific. Family visit travel, if you have relatives there, journalists, and that sort of thing.
So if people were planning a trip to Cuba this year, are they totally out of luck or are there still workarounds for these new restrictions?
a lot of people are indeed out of luck when it comes to their cruise lines. I mean, this all happened very suddenly. People on one of the Carnival ships, for example, woke up this morning to find out that they're on their way not to Havana, but to Cozumel, Mexico. That cruise line offering vouchers and so forth. The other ones doing it, too. So, yeah, cruises for now aren't going to happen. Now, airline flights are still going, and there's a lot more air travel now than there used to be ever since the liberalization. But there, too, you know, you're kind of on your own in this climate. If you get off the plane and somebody asks you what you were doing in Cuba, and you can't sort of fit that visit into one of those permitted categories, the categories that are still permitted, you know, who knows what could happen. So all kinds of uncertainty and, yeah, a lot of disappointed people.
And as we mentioned, the Trump administration is connecting this to the situation in Venezuela, saying basically that Cuba is helping to prop up the Maduro regime in Venezuela.
Yes, and that's ironic because for about the past two decades, ever since Hugo Chavez came to power in Venezuela, the allegation was exactly the opposite, that Venezuela, as much as any other country in the world after the fall of the Soviet Union and so forth, was propping up Cuba by sending its oil there, selling Cuba below-cost oil, keeping that government afloat. Now, yeah, the allegation, exactly the opposite, that Cuba is taking those tourist dollars, and that's what this is all about, and using that to help Venezuela. Also allegations that Cuba was providing troops to aid the regime when there were those moments when it seemed like Maduro might finally be toppled.
So how much of a difference is it going to make to have these new restrictions on, given that, you know, other countries in the world are still allowed to visit Cuba?
There are. It's a big deal, though. If you kind of extrapolate how many people have cruised there so far, there would have been 500,000 cruise passengers alone going to Cuba, a couple million airline seats, and a lot of those people are people who only would have been going because of the liberalization.
Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for Here and Now. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We've spoken here about synesthesia, kind of a cross-wiring in the brain. People with a form called chromesthesia see colors with sounds. Lady Gaga has it. So does Pharrell Williams. Here he is on the Oprah Winfrey Network.
All sounds have a color association with it. So Stevie Wonder's a synesthete. I may hear his chords and hear that this, like, mustard and yellow and oranges and browns.
Well, 28-year-old Melissa McCracken has chromesthesia as well, and she paints the colors she sees in music. You can see her work at hereandnow.org. While we welcome Melissa McCracken, welcome.
Hi.
So chromesthesia, you must have grown up thinking everyone had it, right?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I grew up not even thinking about it at all. You know, it just was something that was natural and never second-guessed it, never even considered that someone might not be experiencing it as well.
That's what you're seeing, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the standard.
right. But so where is the color? Is it in your eyes, like a spot on your eye, or?
The best way that I can describe it is that it kind of sits where my memories sit, but kind of floating in space a little bit. It doesn't inhibit my sight in any way, but it's almost like a filter, kind of above my eye line a little bit.
We're going to get to see how this works for you, or hear how it works for you, but how did you realize, wait, this is different?
So when I was about 15 or 16, I had a navy blue phone, and I thought it would be really interesting to find a song for my ringtone that would match the color of my phone itself. So I was looking through my iTunes. I had a friend with me, and I was searching for an orangish song because I thought it'd be interesting to have complementary colors going on. So I found this Michael Jackson song, and I turned to my friend, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. It's an orange song. It matches my phone perfectly. And he jumped in, and he said, what do you mean it matches? And I honestly thought that he didn't understand complementary colors. So I started to explain to him the color wheel and how it was on the opposite side. And he was like, no, I get that. What do you mean that this song is even colored? So that was kind of the epiphany moment of, oh my gosh, I might be experiencing things differently. But I honestly thought that he was lacking some sort of experience.
You had never before, like, hearing Mary Had a Little Lamb when you were three, said to your mother, wow, everything's so pink.
It's kind of funny because I think we always have associations of visuals with music videos or Windows Media Player, the kind of different colors that come in on the visuals of that. And so I just always thought, okay, visuals are going to go with music, and that's just how it is. And right. you know, I didn't even think it. It was just always there. So
you've begun painting the images that you see. It's a very abstract thing. It almost looks like, you know, like somebody's thrown paint on a canvas, but it's the bursts of color that you see when you hear music. By the way, we'll have some of your pictures at hearandnow.org.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get a sense of what that might feel like. For instance, we know you've done Jimi Hendrix's Little Wing. Great choice. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep it low here. What are you seeing?
So in the painting in particular that I did with this one, I really wanted to make a focal point on the guitar. And it's always had this kind of gold effect to the electric guitar. And it sits in this kind of heavenly bluish and kind of pink and purple cloudy-like area. And that's kind of what comes up every single time I listen to it.
So that's all going on in your head when you hear that music. Can you hear that music and not see that?
I've never tried to stop it. I can kind of focus in on it more than I would if I were going to embark on a new painting or something like that. But I've never felt the need to stop it, so I've never felt the need to manipulate it in any way.
It's beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
Is there really that much color?
Yeah, it is a lot of color going on, and in the experience itself, there's a lot more movement. You know, it's kind of translated into this static image, but there's a lot more movement going on, a lot more fading, and, you know, new images coming in. So it's kind of a picking and choosing process of what elements I feel are most vital to the entire experience.
Kind of like a kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
Let's play John Lennon's Imagine.
Imagine there's no heaven.
So the piano chords kind of have this this sort of marble draped effect of different like blues and golds, and they're kind of melting into each other. And then he also has more of a yellow voice that's kind of floaty and comforting looking, and it also kind of resides in this cloudy like space similar to the Little Wing painting.
When you're painting, you start with a background, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how your mind is? Is it white or, you know, navy blue? Is it, and then color comes on it? Is your mind a canvas?
Yeah, it kind of seems that way. Different songs, I guess, start with different canvases. Sometimes I would say that, you know, my blank mind or the mind at the beginning of a song is more white or cream or just kind of a cloudy-like space. Other times it feels like I'm in the depths of space and that it's a navy blue kind of celestial sort of background. So that all is dependent on what song I'm listening to, but it varies for sure.
Let's listen to Spice Girls.
I don't know which came first, the colors or the song itself and my love for the song. But this, it's a lot of pinks and purples and oranges, and they kind of have smaller shapes to them. But it is more like a kaleidoscope effect, and more little bits are happening in it that don't overpower the entire image.
So here you are, a synesthete, and I know you've met different people with different forms, including your brother?
Yeah, my brother has grapheme synesthesia and spatial sequential synesthesia.
What's that, grapheme and sequential synesthesia? What does that mean?
So the grapheme synesthesia is letters and numbers that are translated into color. And then the spatial sequential synesthesia is where you have anything that comes in a sequential form, like numbers or months of the year or days of the week, they sit in a designated point in space around your body. So I have those forms as well as the chromesthesia.
How do you feel that?
Yeah, so if I'm making plans to meet someone, I might think of Monday kind of to the far right top of my right eye.
I do
essentially.
That. I do that.
Really?
It's almost like you can see, like, sometimes when I'm looking into the future, it's like I don't know, stepping stones or something, or
yeah,
that are, yeah, huh?
Yeah, no, that's I think that it's a fairly common form. My mom also has that form, and my dad does a little bit too.
Wait, so your mom and your dad have a form as well?
Yep.
So do you? I mean, I imagine now, whereas you never talked about this because you didn't realize it wasn't different. I'm imagining now, maybe with your family, you talk about this a lot.
Yeah, it is kind of fun because your mind can be a little isolating sometimes, so it's nice whenever you recognize that someone else also has something similar. And so we'll talk about plans for the summer, and the summer kind of just exists in a very specific spot in your mind, and you know, maybe loops around or is linear looking or yeah, whatever you choose, I guess.
Like calendar pages that go forward. Do you see this entirely as a positive, or is it, I mean, if you have children, would you rather they didn't have it?
Oh, I mean, I honestly love it. Being an artist, I love color anyway, so it is a nice little added little surprise to my world, I guess. The only distraction is that I think sometimes when I meet someone and I know that their name starts with a blue color, that could be an A or an F or something like that. So that gives me too many options for remembering what their name was. But yeah, it's definitely mostly beneficial.
And is that just in your mind, or if you were to look at the printed page, do the letters turn colors?
Well, I can logically see that the letters on the page look generally black, but I can't remove what color is triggered in my mind. It's like if I look at an M, I see the black, but I think magenta, and I can't stop thinking magenta. Oh, so it's kind of outlined in a filter of magenta.
I think you have no choice but to be an artist. and have you ever been studied or talked to anybody about it? Or
I've never had any sort of formal study of it. I have Oliver Sacks actually tweeted about one of my paintings one time. He's pretty big into synesthesia and the brain. So he just wrote something about it being a wonderful visual interpretation of person experiencing synesthesia. So I was honored to have that tweet for sure.
Well, that is Melissa McCracken, who has chromesthesia, a form of synesthesia, which is a cross-wiring in the brain that affects people differently. In her case, she sees music as colors and letters as colors. Melissa, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peas are in season in many parts of the country right now. And here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst wants to celebrate. So lucky for us, she joins us in the studio with some delicious-looking food involving peas. Hi, Kathy.
Hey.
Now, we're in pea season, I guess. Mm-hmm. Late spring, early summer.
We are. I mean, in some parts of the country, it's almost over. And up in Maine, in the north where I live, it's just starting. And all my peas were eaten this weekend by some little critter.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
Don't
it
even
wasn't
get
your
me
husband.
Started.
No.
It was not my husband.
Well,
no.
Can we dispose of all the bumper stickers? Give peas a chance.
There you go.
World
all we
peas.
Are saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, what do we got?
Well, interestingly, I found out, you know, you Google things, you learn things. Peas are actually not literally a vegetable, but of course we know them. They're part of the legume family. That's the plant that produces pods with seeds inside. But the thing about peas is, if you grew up, like I did, eating frozen peas or canned peas, you may think you're not a fan of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you would be wrong, because you need to try them in all these different ways where
they're fresh
and they have fiber and texture. And they, when they're fresh, the only word to describe them is sweet.
Can you listen?
That's nice
that's
snap, Robin.
Yeah,
that's
thank
a
you.
Snap
there you go.
Right there.
The other thing about them is that they're wildly versatile. You can eat them raw, of course. You can steam them, roast them. You can grill English peas on the grill, brushed with olive oil and sea salt, stir fry them. And they're everywhere right now. The place to look is Farmer's Market. I know I sound like a broken record. Mm-hmm. I do not
no,
work
you're right.
for...
food is always better. Vegetables are always better when they're coming from the Farmer's Market. Let's talk about some of the peas that are right in front of us, including a pizza right here that you have made.
It sounds unusual, but I thought, why not? So this white pizza, it has no tomatoes or tomato sauce, features sautéed fresh spring spinach, and then there's peas two ways. There's fresh-shelled English peas that are baked onto the pizza for the last few minutes, and then on top are those beautiful, tender pea sprouts or pea tendrils, which are so delicate. And
they look
add
like parsley.
Yeah, kind of, but they have a little bit of the sweetness of peas, and they mimic the pea taste on the pizza. So we have mozzarella. You can buy your pizza dough, make your pizza dough, a little olive oil, some parmesan, fresh peas, and pea tendrils.
I have to say that I'm usually a person who gets, you know, pepperoni or something like that on pizza.
You're
or Hawaiian
a
pizza,
guy.
But I will say, because I don't go for the veggie pizza first, but this I would do.
Isn't it nice?
It's really
very
delicious.
Delicate, and I love that it's a white pizza and that the tomato's not competing with it. Mm-hmm. So I just talked briefly about English peas because they are on that pizza. These may be my favorite peas. They're also called shelling peas. They're grown for the peas inside, but the pods most people throw out. No, the English pea is the fat one with the string on it that you open,
the
and
pod.
Then you get the big fat peas inside. But don't throw the pod out. It makes this delicious broth, which can be the basis of soup
that's
or
what
stews.
We've got right
you
here.
You have that
some,
in your little coffee cups. Yeah. All that is are pea pods boiled with water.
Oh, wow.
And it gets a sweetness. Imagine that it's the base of a pea and lettuce soup or any kind of vegetarian casserole.
Can I just say what a fun thing for kids? I'm opening my pod now and eating these peas raw, which is fabulous. What a great thing for kids to do.
Exactly. And you know what? You are getting very few calories, a ton of fiber, vitamin A, K, C, protein. This stuff's good for you.
Okay, mm-hmm. And you've got one dish here that has many different kinds of peas in it.
I do. This is a lovely, almost a French-style dish. It's braised chicken with leeks, another spring vegetable. And I used peas three ways. I used snow peas, snap peas, as well as English peas. And I let it cook until the chicken practically falls off the bone. I used chicken thighs. Some garlic, and then I use that pea stock in this so that you taste the peas four different ways. It's all about building levels of flavor.
And what have we got here? This looks like it's a pesto of some sort.
It is indeed. Instead of basil or using other herbs traditionally, this uses fresh English peas mixed with fresh mint. So very summery, would be delicious on thick slices of grilled toast. You could use it on pasta or rice, but also with grilled shrimp or fish or anything you're grilling this summer. It's a very vibrant, beautiful green pesto. Mm.
That would be good for, you know, watching the NBA finals or something like
that.
Yes. Right?
Oh, there's an idea.
Forget about
the
chips and salsa.
NHL, which is coming up.
Right.
Never heard of them.
Some pea tips. Freeze them, put them in the refrigerator.
You know, if you have a load of them in your garden or you find them at the farmer's market, you can freeze them. They clearly they have a different texture. When you're shopping, you want to look for really plump, curvy pods that look full, don't look shriveled or thin. And it should have the same color because as they get older, they dry out and the color fades. So that's an indication that they're not as fresh as they should be. You can keep them in the refrigerator for almost a week. Like corn on the cob, they get starchy the longer they sit around. So buy them, eat them raw, cook with them now. This is the season.
And if you counted how many times we said peas in 5 minutes, please tweet at us here now. We've got all of these recipes for peas at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WB. There's another P. NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.